think I could call, so, and I meant to call after Shabbat, but I forgot.
No problem. No problem.
Nope.
Okay, welcome back. Nice to see friends from around the world joining us, local folk from Efrat, for the Mishkan Tzipora Gemara Shir. We're learning Masechet Ta'anit, and we're on the we're in the middle of Daf Zayin. But I want to go back to something we were in the middle of last week. The whole Daf is dealing with this question of metaphor. And it's kind of like metaphor on metaphors. Rain, the power of rain, the regenerative power of rain. Rain is compared to the Tchiyat HaMetim, to the revival of the dead. It's compared to childbirth. You know, these very powerful images of bringing forth life. This was probably a way that Chazal had to telegraph the idea that I've mentioned now multiple times of how dependent everything was on rain in ways that we don't feel it today, no matter where you live. Even we in Eretz Yisrael, who are still quite conscious of rain, and it's a beautiful, you know, we had a nice rain just before. It started raining the other day, and now this evening it rained again. And my little daughter, my 9-year-old daughter, with her friends, it starts raining. They go running outside and they're dancing in the rain. It's like this kind of, it's built into the Zionist ethos to be excited about rain. The little kids should be excited about rain.
They would call the Miflas a canary. They would call it the Miflas
The Miflas.
Al-Umi.
The Miflas Al-Umi, right? The national, right? As the rain goes up, as the water level in the reservoirs go up, our national spirit goes up. But also, as I've said multiple times, this idea that the rain and the economy, these are things that are all tied much more directly for Chazal than they are for us today. And then, having compared rain to Torah, the Gemara starts comparing other things to Torah. We got hooked up on this idea of fire. I'm going to come back to that a little later. Why is fire like Torah? Among other reasons, because just like you need two sticks to rub together to create fire, like we did in the old Boy Scout days, that's the way it is with Torah. To really create the warmth of Torah, the light of Torah, you need two people together, two people knocking their heads together. And we spoke a bit at length last week about that. The idea that Torah is compared to a tree, Eitz Chaim Hilamachazikim Bo, that there are certain trees that give forth good fruits and there are other trees that don't give forth good fruits. There are trees that seem to be signs of bracha in the Torah, in various psukim, and other trees that are not. So the Gemara had gotten off on this idea, well, you know, it depends on which kind of Torah teacher you're talking about. If it's a Talmid Chacham Hagun, Mimenu Tochal, that you should devour the fruits of Torah that come from a worthy, a virtuous Torah scholar. But somebody who possesses Torah knowledge, and, you know, in theory could transmit it to you, you should not eat of his fruit. That would be a Talmud Chacham she'eno hogen, eino hagun. And even though in theory, you know, the transmission of knowledge, you know, is, you know, this is connected to so many other things, questions about art and artistry, you know, can we enjoy or take pleasure in or participate in the art that's created by artists who are morally problematic. And every time a new Woody Allen movie comes out, there's this debate rages whether or not it's appropriate to see it. Can you separate the art from the artist? Can you separate the Torah knowledge from the possessor of that knowledge? Right? In theory, you could be a menuval. You could be a despicable character who happens to know a lot of Gemara. Is it appropriate to study from him? So Tosfot here at the top of the page says, "Im talmid chacham hagun mimenu tochal." If he's an appropriate, a virtuous Torah scholar, then you can eat of his fruits. Perush lamud lefanav. You can study at his feet. Va'oto lo tichrot. And that's the kind of Torah scholar who's compared to the type of tree that you should not chop down. Klomar lo tifrod, lo tipared mimenu. You shouldn't separate yourself from a proper Torah scholar. Lelech lifnei rav achir. If you have a good teacher who has the knowledge and also has the virtue, you shouldn't separate yourself from him. Ve'im lav lo tamot lifanav. And if he's a person of a dubious character, you shouldn't study with him. Vahad amrinan de'lomdim mitamid chacham afal pi she'eno hagun. Kerebi Meir, Shehaya Lomed Lefnei Acher, B'Masechet Chagiga. And what would be an exception to this rule? Somebody who does study from a non-worthy Torah scholar, that's the case of Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir was a disciple of Rebbe Elisha ben Abuya, the very famous Tana who, as they say, went off the derech. You may be familiar with the wonderful historical fiction As a Driven Leaf by Milton Steinberg, a book that came out, when did that book come out? Probably in the 40s. It was a very long time ago. It's a really wonderful book, a work of historical fiction about this character, Elisha ben Abuya, who was known as Acher, the other one, right? The Tana who kind of hichmitz, went off, got spoiled, followed the heretical ways. And yet Rebbe Meir continued to study with him. So how could that be, as related in Masechet Ta'anit? Hainu dafka talmid chacham acher, yachol lilmod lefanav, lefi shelo yilmod mima'asav. That is talking about Rebbe Meir. Rebbe Meir was already himself a well-established person who was strong in his convictions and strong in his knowledge, and he continued to study from his teacher, who had kind of gotten a little spoiled, gotten a little rotten, gone off, because Rebbe Meir was already at a position where we weren't afraid he was going to become corrupted. But other people, a simple person, eino rashai lilmod lefanav, should not study from a talmid chacham she'eino hagun. Now let's go back to where we were in the Gemara, here towards the bottom. Hold on a second. Okay, here we are. Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa Rami. Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa observed a contradiction. Ktiv, it's written in Yeshayahu, Likrat Tzamei Hetayu Mayim. For the thirsty, you should bring water. Uchtiv, Hoy, kol tzamei l'chul amayim. Anybody who's thirsty should go to water. So in one pasuk it says, bring the thirsty person water. And in the other pasuk it says, the thirsty person should go and seek out his own water. So why? What's going on between these two psukim? Im talmid hagun hu, likrat tzamei teyumayim. Vim lav, hoy, kol tzamei l'chul amayim. If the person is a proper worthwhile, virtuous student. So he's the kind of person who is appropriate to bring the water to him. What's the water? The water is the Torah. In other words, you possess the knowledge. You have a bucket full of water. What's the water? The water is Torah. Pardon me while I drink some. You have the bucket of water. You're in possession of the Torah knowledge. So who should you teach? So if you have the opportunity to teach worthy students, so it's you the teacher, it's your job to seek them out. But if the students are not worthy, meaning if the students are not motivated by proper cause, if the student's behavior doesn't somehow correlate with the values we're trying to teach. Hello, are you there? Hello? Hello? I think we had a little power outage, so I got cut off. But here we are. I'm not sure where I was when I got cut off, but we were looking at the Gemara here at the bottom of Daf Zayin.
You were down around the Glatzameh.
Right. So Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa points out that these two psukim, one says, if you're thirsty, go drink water. And the other one says, if somebody's thirsty, bring him water. And that has to do with this difference between a Talmid Chacham who's Hagun, a student who's worthy. So the teacher has a responsibility to seek him out versus the opposite, where if somebody seeks out to learn with you, well, we have an obligation to teach everyone. If you know a little Torah, you have an obligation to teach Torah. But that doesn't mean that you have to seek out every student. So if the thirsty student comes to your door to drink from your waters, so then you should give it to him. But if not, so then you should be seeking out appropriate students. Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama Rami Ktiv. Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, before it was Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa, this is Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama Rami Ktiv, two contradictory psukim. Yafutsu Mayanotecha Chutsa, a verse in Mishle, that your springs should bubble forth and go out and spread abroad. Uchtiv Yiyu Lecha Livadecha. But the next pasuk says they should be your own. So in other words, you, the Torah teacher, the person who possesses the knowledge, is compared to a spring. Again, Torah is water. So on one hand, the spring should bubble forth and go forth to everyone and flow everywhere. On the other hand, it should be kept private and the individual's domain. So it's the same thing. Im Talmid Hagun Hu, Yafutu Mayanotecha, Chutzav Im Lav Yu Lecho Levadecha. An identical construct to the previous line of the Gemara, just quoting a different pasuk. This idea that there's this dichotomy between whether you should be expansive in your teaching or you should be constrictive in your teaching, it has to do with the nature of the potential students. Now, I mentioned last... Yeah, David.
I was going to say, it seems like actually there might be a disagreement between them. It sounds like with Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa, you're saying you don't have to search him out. But in Rabbi Chanina Bar Chama, he seems to be, the way I understand it, he's saying, love you, lecha levadecha, you'll be alone, you won't teach him at all.
Oh, that's interesting. I understand. Meaning, in other words, you shouldn't give it out even if they come looking.
Yep.
Is it? Maybe. That's your idea?
I'm just looking at that.
Well done. So that I mentioned last week, that those two. Wait a second. I can't share these other. Hold on. Let me see if I can open up these other documents that got lost. Oh, Ben, somehow you became the host. Now I'm reclaiming the host privileges. When I got cut off, you were still able to speak to each other?
Yes,
we were.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Those who didn't mute themselves.
Okay, so last week we looked very quickly at these two Mishnayot at the beginning of Masechet Avot that reflect this idea. There were different attitudes towards what kind of home you should build. Should your home be open only to the distinct and learned, or should your home be open to everyone? Should your house be a Beit Vad Lechachamim, or Yehi Beitecha Patuach Lirvacha, V'yu Ani'im B'nei Veitecha? Right? These are two different attitudes that are represented in the tradition that you can see in these two different approaches. This approach here coincides with the opinion of Rabbi Yossi ben Yoezer. Right? Really, you should be a little more constrictive in your teaching. Presumably, these attitudes vacillate depending upon what's going on in the Jewish world. If it's a time of great learning and everybody's studying and there's a lot of advances in Jewish learning, so I guess you can afford to be a little more discriminating. But throughout much of our history, and certainly modern history, this has not been the case. And the imperative to reach out to people and to teach people and to expose people to things has become paramount. And I think we all understand that.
And that would be the issue of Chabad. They go out to certainly, in search
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah, certainly, Chabad does not. This is also ideas. This idea is also represented in the Gemara in Brachot in Tfilat HaShachar, the famous Agadah about Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria and Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Gamliel, that you know, whether or not the Beit Midrash should be closed, there should be like a very high bar for admittance to the Beit Midrash, or whether or not the door should be thrown open and tens of thousands more people should come in. So the Gemara goes on. Va'omar Rabbi Chanina bar Idi, another Rabbi Chanina, lama nimshalu divrei Torah lamayim. Why is Torah compared to water? Dichtiv hoy called sameluchu lamayim, because that's the verse in Isaiah that we already saw, that everybody gevalt, everyone who's thirsty should come for water. Lomar lecha ma mayim manichim makom gavoha v'holchim lamakom nauch. Af divrei Torah ein mitkaimin ela b'mi shedaato shvela. Why is Torah compared to water? Because water always seeks, you know, that's the way gravity works. Water always seeks the lowest ground, right? If the rain falls on the mountaintop, it's going to dribble down to the valley, right? And that's here when it rains. Where do all those giant putty? We look out into our valley here, across from those of us here in Efrat. You look out into the wadi. Right, and what's those giant puddles of water, right? All the water that's fallen on the mountainside, you know, drizzles down to the bottom. You spill, as happened in my home, you know, somebody knocks over a beverage on the kitchen table. Where does it end up? Right, it doesn't stay on the kitchen table. It all gets down to the dribble, falls off the edge of the table down to the floor. So that's what Torah is. Torah kind of goes down to the lowest level, right, to the shvela, to the, you know, till it hits the bottom and gravity can't pull it any further. Why shvela? So the pshat seems to be that it goes to the place of the most modest, of the most humility, the person whose spirit is lowest. Torah reaches down to them, not to the high person, not to the haughty person. Right, but you can also say that that's the power of Torah, right? That Torah has this ability to kind of work its way everywhere. That's the idea, of course, of the famous Agadah about Rabbi Akiva, that the drip, drip, drip of the water can break through the rock, right? The idea that the water that, like we talked last week about the, whatever it was, the continental divide or the Kav Parashat HaMayim, right? The water is going to fall on our little mountaintop, and it's going to reach far, far away. And ultimately, it's going to get all the way down to the Dead Sea. Right? That's the power of Torah, to spread itself, to get to places unexpected. Like, you know that, you know, anybody knows, God forbid, if you've had any ritivut at home, if you've had a leak or something like that in your house, you know, you never know where it's coming from. Right? You could have like a drip in a faucet, you know, two flights up in your bathroom, and it can manifest itself downstairs in your living room, because just that's the way the water works. It gets into the rafters and it gets into the beams and it slinks its way down. That's the not to compare, you know, a leak in your house, which nobody wants, but you understand the metaphor, that's the power of Torah to get out and to find its way. But it seems that the simple reading of the Gemara has to do with Torah reaches down to the humble, to the low, to the person who is not haughty. V'omer Rabbi Oshaya, lama nimshalu divrei Torah l'shlosha mashkin alalu, mayim yayin chalav. Torah is also compared to water, wine, and milk. Hold on. Why these things? V'chtiv l'chu shivru v'ichlu. No, hold on. D'chtiv, ahoy kol tzameh l'chu l'mayim. So first, Torah is compared to water. This verse we've now seen three times, the verse from Yeshayahu. If you're thirsty, go drink water. That's Torah. V'chtiv l'chu shivru v'ichlu. L'chu shivru b'lo kesef, b'lo mechir, yayin v'chalav. And another pasuk. No, I think it's the same pasuk. The continuation of that pasuk. that you should go and you should go, you should buy, you should eat. And what should you buy? You should buy wine and milk without price. Lomar lecha ma shlosha mashkin alalu ein mitkaimin ela be pachot shebekelim af divrei Torah ein mitkaimin ela bimi shedato shvela. Water, wine, and milk were classically contained. I mean, what do? We keep everything in plastic. I mean, wine we still put in glass jars. But even wine, you can see now, they have that cheap wine that comes, it looks like a juice box. Right? You ever see this? It's like cheap wine. It comes like in a juice box. Water, wine, and milk were held in the simplest of jars, in clay jugs, not in metal, not in other things. That's to tell you these three liquids, water, wine, and milk, that are compared to Torah, just like those liquids are contained in simple earthenware jugs, so too the Torah. The Torah is preserved best in a simple container. Who's the simple container? That's us. How are we simple? If we are humble. Right? Humility is the best container to possess Torah. Ki da amra le Barte de Kesar le Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya. Just like the daughter of the Kesar, the daughter of the Roman Emperor, said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, this is the background story, I think, I'm sorry. Like the daughter of the Kesar said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Hananya, I chochma mifuara b'kli mechuar. If you people have such respect for Torah, if Torah is the greatest, most outstanding thing to you people, how can you have kept it in such an ugly vessel? Apparently, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya was not a very handsome man. Right? I don't know what he looked like. Maybe he had a crook nose and a lazy eye and a hunchback. He wasn't the handsomest fellow in the world, but he was a great scholar. So when the daughter of the Kesar sees him, she says, you know, how could it be that you are the greatest scholar of your age? If you possess the Torah, which is the thing which is most precious to your people, why would God keep his precious commodity in such an ugly vessel? So Amale Avich Rami Chamra Bemane de Pachra. Does your father keep his wine in a clay jug? So she says, Amrale Elabamai Nirme. So what should he keep it in? Amrale Atun de Chashivuto Rami Bamane Dahava Vakaspa. So he says, well, if the wine, you know, wine is a very important drink, you know, if you're a king, you drink wine, they serve you wine. Shouldn't the most exalted beverage of the most exalted member of the royal family be kept in kelim of dahava vakaspa, of gold and silver? So Asli va'amrei lavu, she goes and tells her father, Ram yelachamra b'mane dahava vakaspa, you should keep your chamra, your wine, in gold and silver vessels. Utakev. So he does, and what happens? The wine turns into vinegar. The wine goes sour because it reacts somehow with the metal, and it goes bad. Mana malachachi. So he says, "Who told you to do this? Like, you know, this is, you know, you ruined all the wine." Amar le Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya, karu. Amar le Maya matalachi. Why'd you tell my daughter to put the wine into gold and silver bottles? So Amar le, ki hechi da Amar li, Amri lo. I just repeated to her what she said to me. She had a comment about me. I told her that's what you should do. Va'ika shapire de gemiri. Right? You could be handsome, and you could also learn. Says the emperor to him. So he says, wait a second. In other words, you're not so good looking. And you know a lot of Torah. But you could be handsome and know a lot of Torah. In other words, it's not a perfect example. Because the wine, if you put the wine in the beautiful, right? Al tistakel b'kan kan ela b'mash yesh bo. Don't look at the jug, look at what's in it.
The equation doesn't work.
What?
The equation doesn't work.
The equation doesn't work. If you put the wine in gold and silver, the wine goes bad. If you keep it in a simple clay jug, it stays preserved for a long time. So if you are handsome, if you are ugly, you can know a lot of Torah. If you are handsome, you can know a lot of Torah. Sure. If you're ugly, you can be an Am Haaretz. And if you're handsome, you can also be an Am Haaretz. It's not a good equation. So we have to skip to the next Amud.
Yes.
Wait a second. Hold on. Hold on a sec. I'm sorry.
Yeah, something's coming. There you go.
Okay. So he says, "I havu sanutve havu gmire." So he says, "Enochinami." You can be handsome and learn a lot of Torah, but you know what? If you're not so handsome, it's easier to learn. You can, you could learn more. You're very handsome. You know, there are a lot of distractions in life.
I was trying to remember, but wasn't it in Sanhedrin? Wasn't there a requirement to be part of the Sanhedrin, like some level of attractiveness? Maybe I'm misremembering that, but.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And clearly, what we're about to discuss Rabbi Yochanan, who's described as like the most handsome person in the world. This is Rabbi Yoshua's. This is Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua Bar Chanina's opinion. But you can understand that he's filtering it through his own experience. He says, look, he wasn't so handsome. He was like the hunchback. So he says, maybe like because of my circumstances, like it provided me with, like what's better? Is it better to be rich or is it better to be poor in terms of becoming a great scholar? So like if you're very rich, you don't have to worry about too much. Like you don't have to worry about like where you're going to get lunch. Worrying about lunch is something that often, distracts you from learning. But on the other hand, if you're very rich, so sometimes there are other distractions in life that get in the way. And if you're very poor, so like you don't have anything. So, okay, so you can spend a lot of time learning. So like everybody, I think the point is that you can take your circumstances that life hands you and everything is potentially, I guess if you're very ill, it's like hard to say that that's like an advantage for learning. But on the other hand, maybe not. You know, maybe there are people who use the challenge of being ill, use that to say, "Look, I gotta make the most of it. You always hear stories about people like this who think of what's his name." Hawking, Stephen Hawking, who had he was dealt this bad hand with the Lou Gehrig's disease, but that didn't seem to hold him back from intellectual pursuits and achievement in that realm. So whatever hand life gives you, I guess we'd all prefer like. Health and wealth and wisdom and good looks and things like that. But everything has its advantages and disadvantages. So Rabbi Yehoshua ben Chanina, who didn't have the good looks, he said he found his life, you know, allowed him to focus on his pursuit of Torah. But then the Gemara says, Davar acher, mash lo shamashkin halalu ein nifsalin ela behesach hadat, af divrei Torah ein mishtakchin ela behesach hadat. So then the Gemara gives another reason that water, wine, and milk are compared to Torah. Water, wine, and milk are things that require some attention to preserve it, right? And if you leave water out unattended, you know, like bugs are going to fall into it. If you leave wine unattended, you know, without corking it up or bottling them up, so it's going to go sour. The same thing with milk, right? You have to pay attention to it, otherwise it curdles. So these are things that can be preserved I think I read, like I'm always, it always amazes me. I'll come into the kitchen and there'll be that bottle of milk out on the kitchen table. Somebody had cereal and of course the milk is just magically meant to be put away. So I read once that like you buy a bottle of milk, usually it's good for like a week, right? The date, best if used by, it's like a week or so. But every hour that a milk is left out of the refrigerator, it loses one full day of freshness, right? So if you leave out the milk the whole day, 7-8 hours, you know, it's as good as garbage. So you have to pay attention to it. You know, you can't be masiach dat. You can't be distracted from it. So the same thing with Torah, right? Just like your wine has to be preserved in a certain way. You have to take, you know, people who are real feinschmeckers, who are really mefunakim about their wine. You know, they have wine cellars and wine, what do you call that? The wine cases, and there's a special way that the wine is kept and preserved. And if you do it correctly, you can have bottles of wine that last, 100 years even. I read something not long ago about a bottle of wine that had belonged to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was the American minister to France during the Revolutionary War. And when he came back from France, he brought a large supply of French wine. He also brought a large supply of French grapes in order to start planting vineyards in America, because America did not have very good grapes for wine growing, and he wanted to develop the American wine industry. But he brought bottles of wine from, you know, many cases of wine from France when he came back at the end of the 18th century. And there was a bottle of this wine that Jefferson had brought from France back to America in the 1770s that was auctioned off not long ago, and apparently was still quite good. So if you keep it, if you preserve it properly, it'll last a long time. That's the same thing with Torah. If you don't get distracted from it, it'll be preserved properly. I want to go back to this idea that we saw about wine, about water and fire. The Torah is compared to water. The Torah is compared to fire. Water is generally, the metaphor of water is thirst. It quenches the thirst. If you're thirsty, you come and you can drink from it. If you have the bucket of water, you have an obligation to let your spring bubble forth to other people. The idea of Torah going and spreading and dispersing and getting, you know, to people at all places. But also the idea of fire, that Torah is like fire because it's dialogical. It takes place in the company of two people. When Shnei Talmidei Chachamim that are locked together, right, knocking their heads against each other like the two Boy Scout sticks, right, that's what creates fire. Of course, fire is both light and fire is warmth. But of course, fire is also a little dangerous. Nowhere in the comparison of Torah to water do we say, yeah, you know, you can drown in water. I mean, somebody could have said such a thing, but it's not the case. Water is presented always as, you know, this very important source for life and for everything. But fire is much more inherently you get close to it, you get warm, you get too close to it, you get burned. I mentioned last time this the Agnon story. Hold on. Shnei Talmidei Chachamim Shayu Be'irenu. Agnon has a story about two Torah scholars in a Beit Midrash in Galicia, 4 or 5 generations ago, who lo nochim ze beze b'halacha. They can't get along. This Agadah, this piece of literature, two scholars who are in our town, is based upon some of the ideas here in our Gemara, but it's based upon the Gemara about Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in Bava Metzia, Daf Pei Dalet Omer Aleph, 84a, which I mentioned to you at the end of last week, and I'm just trying to upload here. Why does it keep doing this? I'm sorry, when I got knocked out, all of these things got bumped out. Wait, before we go there, I just wanted to share one other idea from the Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai, who was who wrote a sefer called the Ben Yehoyada. The Ben Ish Chaim was Rav Yosef Chaim of Baghdad. He lived in the 19th century. So he wrote a book called the Ben Ish Chai, and he also wrote a book called the Ben Yehoyada. Ben Yehoyada is a perush on the Agadot. So on this Agadah, on this Gemara, he mentions the following. It's a bit of a strange idea, but it's so charming that it's impossible not to mention it. This idea that Torah is like water, because water goes from the high to the low, that it can, like, you know, Torah flows downhill, right? In other words, if you assume that, like, Torah knowledge is somehow at the top, that the people that know more, right, the point is that their Torah should flow down, right? It should trickle down. It should get to even the lowest person, either the lowest in terms of modesty or the lowest in terms of every single person. It's like the Mishnah in Avot says also, the idea that the Keter Torah is open to all, right? You know, not everybody's royalty, and not everybody is a Kohen, and not everybody is rich, and not everybody's all these other things, right? You're either born into it or you're not. It was a world where class was very much determined by birth. But the one thing that was absolutely democratic was Torah. Everyone can study Torah. All men, and, well, now we would say women, are created equal. It's election day in America, so, you know, like, these are themes that we might talk about. Everyone's created equal in terms of that not everybody has the same advantages. You know, if you're wealthy and your father can hire private tutors for you, you have advantages that the poor person doesn't have. But you are not inherently more entitled to Torah than anyone else. So the Ben Yehoyada says that's why Torah is compared to Mayim. The letter in here, this is, you know, ideas based upon, like, Kabbalah and Gematria and the other types of interpretation of things related to the letters. So, like, the letter Mem, right? There's this idea that all the letters have numerical value, and all the letters have names. Like, why should that be? Like, why should it be that letter that looks like this is called a W? That's a rather I always thought that was a strange name, since after all it looks like a double V, at least in English. In French it's called a double V, right? A double V. But why is this called an X, right? In other words, we have names for these symbols that really represent sounds. Each letter has a name. So in the Jewish interpretive tradition, the names of the letters have meaning. So this letter, the letter that makes the sound, is called a mem. And if you spell it out, at least the way that Ben Yehoyada spelled it, it's mem yud mem. Mayim. Now the fact that mayim, water, is connected to the letter mem, the sound, whose numerical value is 40. And 40, after all, is a rather symbolic number compared to water and compared to Torah. Ayin Parashat Noach, which we read 2 weeks ago, and the 40 days. Ayin 40 days on Har Sinai to get the Torah. The Torah is compared to water. So he says, what's mem? Mem follows the letter Lamed. Lamed is a very high letter, right? The letter Lamed is designed that has this head, this flag, this staff that goes up, right, above the line of the other letters. So mem, mayim, flows away from the letter Lamed to the letters Nun and Samech. So there's an idea, I mean, this sounds a little strange, but it's so cute. There's an idea that the names of the letters have what are called otiyot migulot and otiyot nistarot. So the letter Nun, if you spell out its name, it's Nun Vav Nun. The letter Samech, Samech Mem Kaf, right? The hidden letters are the letters that are not the first letter, right? Obviously, the letter Nun begins with a Nun. So you can discount that. And the letter Samech begins with the letter Samech. So you can discount that. So what's hidden behind this symbol and this symbol? Behind this symbol is the letter Vav and Nun. And behind this symbol is the letter Mem and Kaf. And if you rearrange them, you get Nun, Mem, Vav, Kaf, Namuch. So that the Mayim flows from the high place to the namuch place, to the low place. I mean, if it didn't resonate so perfectly with the Gemara we just read, you would think it was a little odd. But nevertheless, this is what the Ben Yehoyada says. Okay, the Gemara in Bava Metzia. The Gemara in Bava Metzia tells the story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan had it all. He had yichus, and he had wealth, and he had good looks. He was extremely handsome. Reish Lakish did not have any of these things. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, he's called Reish Lakish. He actually, at least according to the Bavli, he made a living as a bandit, as a highwayman, as a, according to some interpretations, as a gladiator. One day, Reish Lakish, he goes down to the river to bathe. And he sees this very beautiful, what he mistakes from the distance to be a beautiful woman. And he jumps into the river after her. When he gets close, he sees it's not a woman at all. It's a man. It's Rabbi Yochanan, who apparently was beardless. And maybe from a distance, that's why he was confused for a woman. Rabbi Yochanan says to Reish Lakish, "Oh boy, if you would only use your power for Torah, you'd be great in Torah." But he saw that here was somebody that was incredibly, incredibly physically endowed. He took a javelin or something and he did this high jump dive into the water. So if you'd use your power for Torah study, you'd be a great scholar. And Reish Lakish says, "You're so good looking, if you'd use your good looks properly, you'd get all the girls." So Rabbi Yochanan says, you want girls? Listen, do tshuva. Come to the Beis Medrash and learn Torah. And I will marry you off to my sister, who's even better looking than me. Vekachava. And the two of them became brothers-in-law, and Reish Lakish becomes a great scholar, and they study together. One day in the Beit Midrash, hold on, let me... Right? Here, one day in the Beit Midrash, there's a conversation that's going on. Yom Achada Havu Miflagei Beit Midrash. One day there was a machloket in the Beit Midrash. Hasayif, Vasokin, Vapigyon, Varomach, Umagal Yad, Umagal Katsir. All of these objects, a sword and a knife and a dagger and a spear and this kind of thing and that kind, all of these different weapons of war. Me'ema time kablin tuma. Mishat gemar malachtan. Now you know that in the days of Chazal there was something called tuma v'tahara, ritual purity and ritual impurity. And if an object became impure, it couldn't be used for sacrificial stuff. It couldn't be used to eat holy food items like truma or the korbanot, the sacrifices that a person could eat. But not everything can become tame. Not everything can be mekabel tuma. An object which is in the process, a vessel which is in the process of being made, cannot become ritually impure until the production has completed. So the question is, on all these things, when you're making a sword, when is it a sword? In other words, there's a certain point where you have like a hunk of metal and you start working on it and the blacksmith is preparing it, etc. At what point do we say it's no longer raw material? And it is now the object itself. And once it becomes the object itself, it is now susceptible to becoming tamei. So we have to determine at what stage on the production line does this happen. Me'ematai gmar malachtan. At what point is the craftsman done with the work? Rabbi Yochanan amar mishe yitzarfem bekivshan. When you fire it in the kiln, right? In other words, you know the blacksmith, when he's doing it, you know, he's banging on it. So the last time it goes into the fire, so then it is now the sword, and at that point it can become tameh. V'reish Lakish amar mishi yitzach tzechan b'mayim. When you're done pulling it out of the fire, you stick it into a barrel of water. I remember years ago when our eldest son, who's now 23, he was a little boy, we were in Prague. And in the towns, if you've been to Prague, you know the old town square where they have that clock? You've been there? You've been to Prague?
Yeah.
You remember the days when you could travel?
Yeah.
So they had a blacksmith. I mean, I think it was there, it was mostly for show. But there was a blacksmith who was making things. And we stood there for the longest. My son, he was a little boy. He was maybe like 4 years old. And he was just fascinated with this. Like they were making. We have in our backyard, we have this kind of metal bell that hangs in our backyard, which we bought there. But like this idea, you know, he puts it into the fire. He takes it out. And the metal is so hot that you can actually manipulate it. And then you stick it into the fire. You stick it into the water with the tongs. And the metal is so hot that this water lets off steam and crackle and whatever. So Rabbi Yochanan says the finishing touch is when you take it out of the fire. And Rabbi Reish Lakish says no. It's when you put it into the water. And that's the machloket that they have. You know, it's no different than any other machloket that we've seen 1,000 times in the Gemara. Except this time, what does Rabbi Yochanan say? Omar le lista belista tea yoda. A bandit in his banditry knows his stuff. Well, we're talking about weapons of war here. What do I, Rabbi Yochanan says, what do I know about weapons of war? I'm a yeshiva bocher. I've spent my life in yeshiva. But Reish Lakish, he used to be a bandit. Mistama, he knows a thing or two about weapons of war. It was an offhand remark. Right? It was insensitive. He didn't mean anything by it. But it wounded Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish was so hurt by this. He was so pained by this. He was so offended by this. Reish Lakish had spent, we don't know, however many years improving himself, growing, being Chozer B'Tshuva, learning Torah, doing all these things. And with one light-handed remark, the person whose opinion was more important to him than anyone else's belittles him and says, after all, he's still who he used to be. And this is what the Rambam says, that it's a terrible, the Gemara in Yoma says, the Rambam codifies it in Hilchot Tshuva, it's a terrible thing to remind a Baal Tshuva about his past. Right? Because it's as if to say that all of the accomplishment, all of the growth that you've made is really worth nothing. Reish Lakish is so put off by this, he becomes ill. And he dies. And Rabbi Yochanan understands what he's done. And he says, V'omar, Hecha at Bar Lakisha, Hecha at Bar Lakisha. V'have katsavach ad shaf da'ate mine. Rabbi Yochanan understands what he's done, because it was the shnei sakinim chadidim zedze bahalacha. Just like to sharpen a knife, you have to smash it against another knife, right? That was the chevruta that they had, and they bring him other people to study with, and he would say a halacha, and they would bring 100 proofs why he was right. And he said, I don't need yes men. I need Reish Lakish, because I would say a halacha and he would tell me 100 reasons why I'm wrong. And that's how the knowledge of Torah is expanded. Right? That idea of the arena of people battling out the ideas in the arena, right? To get to a greater truth. It's the opposite of the kind of debate that we've seen in American politics this season. Right, which does not expand understanding and wisdom and knowledge. And he says, I need a Reish Lakish. Now the two of them saw the essence in fire or in water. What really makes something what it is? Is it the fire, which is what Rabbi Yochanan says? Or is it the water? Like Reish Lakish. Of course, Reish Lakish himself had a very transformative experience in water. He jumps into the water, and after his encounter in the river with Rabbi Yochanan, he comes out and he's transformed. He's a new man. He's on a new path. He was raw material, and now he's the real thing. Reish Lakish understands that it has to do with fire. What's fire? Fire is the metaphor for Torah of the warmth and light that's generated through the interaction of ideas, the two sticks rubbing together, the two swords crossing. And when he's deprived of that, he realized now he's just a stick, right? One stick can't light itself on fire without the tension, without the creativity that's generated, the sparks that fly when two sticks are rubbing together. Right? For one, the Torah is transformative as compared to the water. For the other, it's creative and as compared to fire. So perhaps their idea for what makes an object become itself is reflected in the difference of opinion in our Gemara and Tanit about whether Torah is like water or whether Torah is like fire. If you read these two Gemaras together. Okay, we are at the top of Zion Omud Beis, and we'll continue next week. Apologies for the earlier technical difficulties.
Thank you very much.